You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, July 18th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, not in the literal nor metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building, but rather in the Kobo Center in Detroit, Michigan, for Netroots Nation 2014, ladies and gentlemen. We're trying to put the YouTube up. It is not working. Just another huge pain in a technological pain in the butt. But we've got a great show for you today. Sorry about that. And first up on the program, let me just take a moment to tell Scott, no, the video is not working. It's not sending the data there, so I don't know. Just hit record. Hit record and hit record there. Maybe we'll have it recording. I don't know. Maybe it's working now. Who knows? But who cares about video when we have audio, which is really the best way to enjoy a program like this, and particularly our next guest. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know if he remembers. Well, I should just say the great blogger, of course, from Esquire and writer at Grantland and Sports, the wonderful Charlie Pierce.
Hi, Sam.
Hello, Charlie.
This is fun.
Now, I have
radio at the end of the world. This is great.
Yes, we are literally about as far from the center of action as we can. Well, I've been in worse.
I was just saying the world is ending. We'll be in a nuclear war by like 3 o'clock this afternoon, right?
I have not been. I have not been following the latest in terms of the airplane. But do tell.
Well, no, I walked out of here yesterday and turned on the news when I got back to my room, and, you know, they're shooting down airliners in the Ukraine, and Israel's running amok in Gaza, and
right.
All of a sudden, things have gotten very serious, very fast, in a very volatile part of the world.
Yeah, indeed. And they're turning off water here in Detroit.
Yeah, and they're turning off water in Detroit, exactly.
Not going to necessarily have the same geopolitical impact, but, there's been many times, I have to say, on this program that I basically feel like I'm doing color commentary for the sort of the ongoing rolling apocalypse.
Yeah.
It's weird when you're here, you're sort of out of the news loop in some respect. And I don't know if you remember, but I think the first time I met you was
Pittsburgh, I believe.
I think it was before Pittsburgh.
Really? Because Pittsburgh was the first one of these I went to.
Then maybe it was Pittsburgh.
Okay, because I was pitching a book at the time, so I was, you know, importuning strangers on the street. So,
and give me your take. I mean, at that point, you didn't have a blog.
Working for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine. I did pop up at Eric's place. I began my career on the internet posting letters to the editor on Jim Romanesco's site years and years and years ago. Jim is an old friend of mine from college. He was a couple years behind me at Marquette, and all of a sudden he popped up with, you know, what was at that point journalism's kind of town square.
Right.
you know, since it's, you know, it's, since it's become one of many things like that. But yeah, and I would post every Friday on Eric's site, wherever that would be. I mean, it was at MSNBC for a while. It was at Media Matters for a while. It was at The Nation. So I just sort of followed him along, and that's where I did my blogging, you know.
And he got to the point where he would just basically take the day off, it seems.
Well, like, let's now, sort of now. He's a busy man. Let's not say that. But I did sit in a couple of times in the big chair, as did my friend Bob Bateman, who posts on my blog, Lieutenant Colonel Bob Bateman.
Uh-huh.
That's where I ran into him, because he was posting on Eric's site, too. But, yeah, that's where it started. That's where I got in the Internet. But I had written Idiot America, and I was plugging, you know, I was pitching the book. That's why I went to Netroots in 2009. That was the first time I'd ever been.
And have you come, you haven't been to each one?
No, I was in Providence. That was the other one.
Right.
This is my third.
Right. Providence, of course, is just down the road.
Yeah.
I think we've mentioned it on this show. For a while, I was doing, like, you know, multiple shows. So
yeah.
It's hard to keep track on where, but you're a Worcester native.
I am.
And I'm not exactly a native. I was actually technically born in New York.
Really?
For a couple of years, my parents had moved out of Worcester, but my dad's been living in the same house. He's living in the same house now than he did when he was, well, about 70 years ago.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, that's terrific.
So there's both my folks, obviously, are from, yeah, from Worcester. But so, I mean, if we had Michael from The Office here, it would be
now.
It would get a little bit problematic.
Yeah, there would be. I would have to explain to you how my grandfather the cop used to have to bust the drunken employees of my grandfather the sign painter on Milbury Street on Saturday night.
Jeez, oh, really?
Yeah,
that must have made so separate grandfathers.
Yes, yeah. My paternal grandfather was a Worcester detective, a patrolman, and then a detective. And my maternal grandfather owned the Macy Sign Company, which was located on where is now the arena, down on Foster Street.
Right.
So, yeah, his employees, as my parents found this out after they met, of course, his employees would go out on Milbury Street into the buckets of blood, as my father used to call them, and they would get busted by Sergeant Pierce, who would take them to, you know.
So is that how your parents met?
No, it is not how my parents met. My parents met after World War II. My dad came back from the war. But as I tell people, I always get a kick out of the meritocracy argument regarding affirmative action in things like police forces. My grandfather walked off the boat from Ireland with absolutely no law enforcement experience and walked right onto the Worcester Police Force in 1918 or 19 because he had a brother there who was already a fireman, or an uncle, right, a cousin, excuse me, who was already a fireman. And that was our first step up the ladder. That enabled him to send, you know, all of his children to school. My father was a public school teacher for 35 years, bought his house on a GI Bill because he was involved in a big government program called World War II. And, you know, I'm the product of public, you know, of the public sector.
And when your grandfather walked off that boat, there was no line. There was no tests at that point?
No, he had a cousin on the fire department.
Right. Yeah.
He had to work as a security guard at United Steel and Wire for like a year to get law enforcement experience before they put him on the force. And he rose all the way to be a detective sergeant. I never met him. He died in 1945. He had caught a lymphoma fairly young. But, you know, my grandmother was a shepherd and then came to the United States and became a domestic. I mean, I'm sounding like, you know, Julian Castro or somebody here, but in fact, I've talked to Julian Castro about this. I mean, the immigration thing holds a lot of, you know, family resonance for me.
Yeah,
you know, and I tell people, you know, my grandfather walked off the boat in 1919, right into a job for the Worcester Police Department, which did not hire its first black patrolman until the 1970s.
Yeah,
so 60 years, three generations of black children in the in Worcester.
Denied.
We're denied the opportunity my family had the minute my grandfather walked off the boat, and you can't explain it any other way.
You know, you had a piece that I guess it was last week about admonishing the president for not going down to the border.
Yeah, I think there was absolutely no reason for him not to, and I used as a historical example LBJ going to I forget the name of the hurricane, but it was a huge hurricane hit Louisiana, and he went there. And he told them, your president is here to help you. It's important for presidents to do that.
Right.
I mean, and yes, I understand that this particular president president going to an area where there are armed yahoos running around everywhere is a security concern.
Right.
But you're still president of the whole country, and the face of the country's charity should not be Glenn Beck. It should be the president of the United States.
Back up to explain people that, because I don't know, and this is important, I think. My feeling is, because I perceive what's happening there not as a national emergency, because the nation is in no danger from whether it's 50,000 kids from Central America or whether he was in, like, can you imagine, 100,000 children. The nation's in no danger. This is not a national emergency. This is a refugee problem.
It's a refugee crisis, exactly.
And the emergency is really for these kids who have decided that they're living in such a state of emergency that they will basically do just about anything to get out of that.
And they're living in states of emergency as a result of actions, at least partly, results of actions this country has taken in Central America, from the drug war to the Contras to, the backing dictators in Guatemala, backing dictators in El Salvador. We help create a culture of violence in these countries, and it's just morphed over into the war on drugs now.
Yep. And so get back to your point about Glenn Beck.
Yeah, Glenn Beck is putting together, he's loading trucks full of, hot meals and soccer balls and bringing them down there and saying that regardless of what he thinks about immigration, and we all know, he's, well off into the Isonosphere. He's doing something to help. And when they get the soccer ball and when they get the hot meal, they don't care where it's coming from. It's coming from Glenn Beck. It's not coming from the President of the United States. That's not the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems to me, and I just saw this, I think maybe it was last night, that basically Pelosi said, our first immigration bill should not be to screw over these kids.
Right.
and I don't know if the White House is sort of backing off this whole thing where we need to expedite the process. I mean, you're talking about expediting the process, basically, of, and I don't know how many kids, and it's impossible to calculate, but you're basically saying we're going to expedite the process of getting at least some of these kids killed. A certain percentage of them raped.
Yeah.
And we want to get this done as quick as possible so they can get down there so that guy waiting for them back in El Salvador.
Yeah.
And
let's not forget, these kids have already been through hell. They got to get here. They got to want it bad.
Yeah.
I mean, they got to really want it bad.
Yeah. It is it's stunning to me that, and the president seems to me, there's two things. One, it's morally reprehensible, I think, that he's not going down there and being aggressive about pushing this. But I also think that it's also politically, I actually think that if the president went down to the border and said, these are kids, these are just kids. I could actually stand amongst them and I'm not getting, some type of...
I'm not getting Ebola.
I'm not getting Ebola. I'm not getting the flesh-eating disease.
Yeah.
And I actually think that it would be effective politically for him. I think it would be healthy for the country, and I actually think it would help the immigration debate. And it seems like just a massive lost opportunity.
Yeah.
These guys, I just don't... Aside from the fact that I don't like a lot of their ideological bearing from the Obama administration, their politics seem... They're not good at it.
And he's got nothing to lose. He's not running again. It's not like the Republicans are going to get any less nutty. They're going to be, they're going to throw a nutty whether they throw a nutty or not. I mean, whether he goes there or not.
Yeah, excuse me. Sorry, we got some sound issues here. This is me. This is Charlie. If you need to, that's the thing. Is that I don't know if it's there are senators in certain races who are saying like we're nervous about this issue. If you go down there, somehow it's going to have a bad bearing on us. I mean, it's not inconceivable to me that there are those senators who say that. I also think that's also political malpractice. I mean, it's the same thing with the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
My contention has always been that there is not a single voter who is going to vote for a Democratic candidate because they're waffling on the Affordable Care Act. Like you're not going to motivate
the
Republicans to get out more if you embrace the Affordable Care Act, because they already think it's like, you know, creeping into their homes and turning them gay.
Yeah.
if that's what they think it is. So
or they're benefiting from it and they decided that it isn't the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
That they're benefiting from.
That's right. That's right. It's I signed up to Connect.
The Kentucky thing is a perfect example.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, Mitch McConnell saying I support Connect, but I don't support the Affordable Care Act.
And all those Democrats who ran away from it now are not getting the benefit because they didn't spend the time sort of making the connection. Hey, incidentally, we have the Affordable Care Act here in Kentucky. It's the Kentucky Connect or whatever it is around the country. It's almost like sitting down to play blackjack and saying, I'm going to take a hit. When the dealer's got a 13, I got a 13, I'm going to take a hit.
Yep.
And then you lose. And then the next time you say, okay, this time I'm not going to. And then you lose. And the next time you say, I am going to. And you switch back and forth, and you actually just sort of destroy your odds of winning in any way.
Well, the other thing is, I don't understand why you can't make an effective political case out of the fundamental immorality of not accepting the Medicaid money. Free federal money. I mean, I despair of our state politicians. You imagine if you offered, like, Huey Long or James Michael Curley free federal money to take care of poor people. Okay, they'd graft some of it, but there's no way they would turn it down. Free money. If conservative politicians are so opposed to this that for ideological reasons they will turn down free federal money, they're unworthy of being American politicians is what I say.
Well,
free dough.
It is pretty stunning that who is his drop? I think again that is part of the sort of not embracing the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I obviously had some issues and still have issues with the broader construction of it. I mean, I don't like the idea that we're salvaging an industry that, as far as I could tell, was in its own death spiral. But it is what it is at this point. And by not embracing it, you're not able to make those arguments about Medicaid, right?
It's what you got. I mean, putting on my sports writing hat for a minute, it's having an NBA team and you have one star and the star comes up for negotiating a new contract. And you say, well, he's not LeBron James. No, he's not LeBron James, but he's what you got.
Right.
You're not going to get LeBron James. He's what you got. You have to decide whether that's worth it. The Affordable Care Act is what we got. And you might as well defend it because, as you said, you're not going to get any political advantage out of opposing it because because the people who are really opposed to it aren't going to believe you.
Right. And not only that, when you don't support it, you lose opportunities that come up from a political standpoint.
Yeah, when the Affordable Care Act, this is something that's bugged me. When the Affordable Care Act was passed, we heard a lot from people, those of us who weren't, as you said, totally sold on the way it was done or what was in it or how it bailed out the insurance companies. We were told, look, pass this thing, it's the first step. You know, once we establish that healthcare is a right, and once we establish a national system, then we can move along to whatever. I have not heard one politician make that argument since the bill was passed. Not one. Not the president, certainly. I haven't heard one Democratic politician say, look, I know there are problems. It seems to be working for a lot of people. So obviously the principle is correct. But let's see what we can do once we establish this. And by running away from it, you're guaranteeing that it isn't established.
Right. I mean, there are a couple of court cases, actually, that still remain that are quite dubious.
Sure.
This Halbig, I guess it's Halbig v. Burwell now.
Yeah. Burwell's going to be all over the law books in 30 years. You know that?
Well, exactly.
People are going to think Burwell was like the most powerful person in the history of the world.
That's right. Well, I should tell you, because it used to be Halbig v. Sebelius.
Sebelius, yeah.
And now it's Burwell, obviously, because new health and... HHS secretary. But that case in particular is based upon just the idea that in the Affordable Care Act, it was written that people would only be eligible for subsidies in exchanges set up by the state or established by the state, I think is the actual wording. And, of course, Some of the states outsourced it back to the feds. In fact, the majority of states, I guess 34, 33. And so these subsidies are being challenged in that instance. And if it's a three, I think we're very far away from that decision being made in a way that it's possible this three-judge panel will rule again in favor of the plaintiffs. Which is very problematic, but then the government could take it to the entire D.C. Court of Appeals, and so I think there's a much better shot there. And that's because of the essentially the filibuster reform.
Right.
You wouldn't have been able to fill up those 11 judges. The Republicans were saying, like, you don't need a
reform. You don't need
it. You have it on there. You just keep it to eight. And it's just coincidentally, five are appointed by Republicans. But it's... I don't know. I mean, I think there's maybe down the road somebody embraces it more, but I don't. I don't see.
I don't
that
see it in this election.
No.
I mean, it's too. I mean, I don't. I mean, there. Who is it? Somebody now I'm having a senior moment because I don't remember. Some politician and a Senate candidate, Democratic incumbent, embraced it, and I can't remember who it is now. But he went out of his way to latch onto the good parts of it and say, look, this is what's working.
Right. I can't.
I don't remember who it is, either. But I don't think it was one of the Udalls, but
I don't know who it was. All right, but let's turn to. I just want to get a little meta here in terms of this. Your first one was in Pittsburgh, and that was back I think in 08, right?
Nine.
Oh, yeah. Nine. Okay, and I think back then still. The change had not happened with what was going on. I mean, give me your sense of
well,
how,
I mean,
how
I'm a little bit, and because this probably is an after a, part of my post-traumatic stress from having gone to CPAC this year. I'm amazed that by the lack of politicians here coming at least to be seen. I mean, I've met some people who are running congressional races, and that's terrific. I'm glad they're here. But, you know, Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren, and that's it. And Reverend Barber last night, by the way, who, if you missed.
Yes, he was
we got to bring American politics above the snake line.
Yeah.
Was tremendous. And if he doesn't keynote the 2016 Democratic Convention, I'm not going. I'm saying this right now. But, you know, I went to CPAC and everybody was there. I mean, everybody came. Every possible candidate came. Every washed-up candidate came. Here, you know, why isn't Martin O'Malley here? I mean, I understand why Mrs. Clinton is
That
here.
Is the one politician I'm shocked is not here.
Yeah.
Because I would have thought O'Malley would have been here if he has any aspirations in 2016, which all indications are that he does.
Yeah.
It's not like this is such a huge constituency, but it's a pretty important one. I mean, these are the sort of the ground forces.
Well, yeah, these are people
respects.
Who, you know, how many of these people have their own blogs? How many people have these, you know, have their own internet radio stations or something? I mean, this is an audience that the Clintons are going to ignore. I mean,
I think largely, although I would be surprised if
I mean,
she
I won't
do
ignore
so.
Them totally, but right. I mean, this is not the audience there. This is not the constituency. This is the constituency they want to keep tame.
Yes, indeed.
But they don't necessarily want to be the champions of.
Indeed.
I mean, and I thought Elizabeth Warren this morning, when I had never heard her go that hard about trade in her speech.
Didn't hear the speech. Tell
yeah,
us a
yeah.
Little
she
bit
she
about
went.
It.
She framed trade deals as part of the way the game is rigged because they're negotiated in secret, and you know, and it was part of her litany of ways the game is rigged, and that's a shot across the bow of Mrs. Clinton. Because if there's one thing the Clinton administration...
NAFTA,
the Commodity Futures Trading Act,
yep.
The repeal of Glass-Steagall, that economics is what got Elizabeth Warren elected. And I don't think the Clinton campaign, Mrs. Clinton's campaign, is going to distance itself from those economics.
Right.
And there's a constituency in this party that isn't going to let her do that. And this is it. So if you're going to run against her, if you're Martin O'Malley, why aren't you here?
Yeah,
why aren't you introducing Elizabeth Warren? Why aren't you, you know, meeting the people who are here? And the other thing that I'm interested in about this, there doesn't seem to be, except for the water rally this afternoon, there doesn't seem to be a huge environmental presence here.
Interesting.
There's some anti-fracking people here, but you would think there would be an anti-Keystone Pipeline booth here in the hall, and there isn't one. There isn't even really a presence. Mountaintop removal, that kind of stuff, not here.
That's interesting. I mean, I've seen, certainly in the past, I've seen certainly like mountaintop removal people.
Yeah.
But it's true, like, it's surprising that that you don't have 350.org here. It is surprising that there doesn't seem to be as much of an environmental presence. I haven't gone through all the... I didn't look specifically in the pamphlets, but this year seems to be really, as much as any, more about sort of less about issues and more about process.
More about organizing. Yeah, I agree.
And certainly, I think that is generally true of the trend of this convention.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely been the trend. It's more about the process, less about an issues. There's not as much of a sense of mission here. And also, there's not as many bloggers. It is more people from institutions here.
Right.
And organizing groups.
Yeah.
It's been interesting how it's changed.
It's almost like this particular constituency has developed its own establishment.
Yes.
You know, not the establishment, but an establishment.
Yeah, yeah, things have become very much institutionalized here in some ways. But Charlie, always a pleasure.
That's terrific, Sam. I'm glad to see you here.
Yes, and tonight we're going to go. You're going to take me to that bar?
I may. The old Miami, the veterans, the Vietnam veterans bar.
All right, well, let's do it. We got two nights. Let's do this.
All right. Thanks, Sam.
All right. Charlie Pierce, everyone. And I think... Will you get Stephanie Kelton for me? Stephanie Kelton, she's right over there. We're going to take a quick break, folks, and we'll be back in just a second. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. And I am live at Netroots Nation. And joining me here on Radio Row is Stephanie Kelton. She is a professor of economics at University of Missouri, Kansas City. I generally do much better on the titles, but I...
That's okay.
I got people running in and out. And of course, I hope people have many, many people listen to the last time you were on the program where we were talking basically about money and modern monetary theory, which is and basically what you talk about on New Perspectives, your blog. And so I hope people will go back to that. But... Give me a sense of, from the perspective of MMT, and I don't know if it necessarily, this is even the right way to frame this question, but in terms of where we are with our economics right now, is there a unique perspective on where we are right now in terms of measuring what's going on in the economy from the perspective of modern monetary theory, or is it... Is that more about how we would address our situation?
Yeah, I think it's more about how we got here, why we're still in the doldrums, and then what are the options for getting out, right? So I think that there are different explanations for sure, and different economists coming from different schools of thought will tell you, you know, we have a slow recovery because we have too much regulation and too many taxes and all that. Or some people would say, well, we have a slow recovery because we don't have enough demand to buy all the stuff that our businesses want to produce. So I'm more in that camp. But it's not unique to MMT. just a general Keynesian sort of perspective.
And to what extent, you know, the story of Kansas, the state, is getting quite a bit of attention.
Yeah.
And that is, it seems to me, one of the purest forms of this notion of I guess, supply-side economics and the Laffer curve comes in there. I mean, give us your sense of what's happening in Kansas.
It's really bad. And as you said, it's getting a lot of attention right now because the experiment has had a bit of time to play out. Now the results are in. And so what's happened is we've had a governor, Governor Sam Brownback, who said, you know, I'm going to bring in some experts and I'm going to get some advice to figure out how to make the state, you know, have more prosperity. So he brings in a guy called Art Laffer, who's an economist, and you mentioned the Laffer curve, and he's famous for this idea that all you have to do is reduce tax rates, and you know the money comes raining down because when taxes are lower, it incentivizes people, and they suddenly start working more and producing more, and all of a sudden there's so much prosperity that tax revenues start pouring in, and now you got more money than you know what to do with. So Brownback said, well, great, let's do that. So he cut taxes. I mean, taxes on businesses were cut to zero in Kansas. Okay?
And by businesses, we mean S-corps.
Anybody who can call themselves a business.
Right.
Yeah.
And so theoretically, the majority report, if we were out of Kansas right now, we would be paying no state taxes.
Right. That's right. So income taxes have come down and business taxes have been cut to zero. And now the state is absolutely starved for cash. There's no money. Right. And so this is what people are beginning to see. They're beginning to see this is just a failed experiment, this supply side stuff. It didn't trickle down. It dried up.
And the interesting thing, I mean, of course, you know, one of the things that's very different between the state government and the federal government in this instance is the state government has to balance its budget. I guess, I don't know if it's constitutional or statutory in Kansas.
Almost every state has a mandate to balance its budget, and Kansas does.
And they don't print their own money, at least not for the time being.
Yeah, well, they're totally constrained in a way, right, that the federal government isn't, which is why every time you have a disaster, like a mudslide or an earthquake or a fire or whatever it is, hurricanes, states don't, you know, turn to one another for help with assistance. They go to the federal government for assistance because that's where the money comes from.
And so, I mean, do you think that there is, you know, I mean, I think there was a time where the supply side seemed to have was in some ways, I guess, exiled, you know, from sort of mainstream thought. Maybe it never did, but where do you think, will economists look back to Kansas as sort of a seminal moment where this put a stake in the heart of a supply side economics?
Well,
Arthur Laffer
laughing all the way to the bank?
No kidding.
The state of Kansas paid him $70,000 for the advice, which is you should cut taxes because my Laffer curve says so. And this is his bread and butter. So he goes around collecting, you know, these huge paychecks. It's like asking your barber, do you think I should get a haircut? What do you think they're going to say?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. You should get a haircut. Arthur Laffer, you know, cashes in big, and the state of Kansas and Wisconsin and many, many other states have followed this advice. And so it's not just Kansas that gives us an example, but your question is, you know, is this going to deal a deadly blow to supply side theory once and for all? I would like to believe so, but I seriously doubt
it. Arthur Laffer is getting
paid
somewhere
else. Because there's
always going
to be, you know, right now, Brownback is blaming Obama. This isn't my fault, right? My tax cuts would have worked, but look what he's done with health care and all this other stuff. So they are...
How is that selling? Do you have a sense?
Well, it's not selling very well for him in the state of Kansas. I've seen four polls. There have been four major polls, and he's trailing in three and by a pretty significant margin and to a pretty liberal candidate from, of all places, Lawrence, Kansas, which is the most liberal part of the entire state.
Wow.
So, you know, in a place where Sebelius won, right, as a moderate Democrat, this is someone who doesn't have the sort of Sebelius look and feel, and yet he's trouncing him in most of the polls right now. So people
are fed up.
And they love their schools. I mean, Kansas has really good schools, or has
had. Part of the story I'm not as familiar with. I understand they have cut severely education.
They've cut, significantly. And so there are ongoing battles where the Supreme Court has to come in, the state Supreme Court, and say, look, you have an obligation. You've got to fund the schools to a level that we determine, right, is appropriate. And the state keeps saying, well, there's no money, so we can't do that, and you can't make us do that. And so, yeah, they've closed schools, class sizes are getting bigger, kids are being, you know, crammed into classrooms. Parents have been told, you know, we used to bus kids. If you lived more than a mile away from the school, we'd come get your kid and take him to school. Now you have to live more than 2 miles away or 3 miles. You know, the radius keeps getting bigger, and it becomes a real hardship on parents. So I think it's a big part of the reason that he is doing as poorly as he is.
Yeah, that just seems like a massive political miscalculation. Schools affect so many people that I'm surprised by that.
Yeah,
I don't know where else, though, you would cut, I guess.
It is. It's the biggest part of the budget, and that's what the Republicans always say. If we've got to cut, it's got to be education, because it's over 50% of the total budget. So, you know, on the one hand, they love to say we've got, you know, these companies that are headquartered in the state of Kansas, like Sprint and other big corporations, and part of the reason they come to Kansas is because
they pay no taxes.
And we have, yeah, well, now, but we have this well-educated workforce,
uh-huh.
right? They build up the schools and say, this is the reason we're able to attract these companies. They come for the workforce, but at the same time now undermining the strength of the schools that they claim are part of the engine for economic growth.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
All right. Well, and let's finally, what, I mean, I think, you know, I imagine this is your first time at Netroots.
Yeah.
And I want to hear your impressions. I imagine you're coming to this as part of, you know, the outreach to spread sort of the message of MMT. Is that?
Well, it's nice that people like you will let me come on and talk about it. That's an awesome part of this. It was a little bit curiosity, and I thought maybe I would just meet some nice people that I sort of know through uh-huh. social media, but I've never met, and we could have some conversations, and maybe, you know, if we have a conversation that is interesting and they begin to think differently about the sorts of constraints that government has with respect to ability to pay for things, then, you know, they've got their own big networks, and then the message just spreads that way. So yeah, that's part of it for sure.
And so give me your impressions of Netroots.
I'm having a great time here. I haven't been able to go to any panels because I've had some work I've had to sit and do, but this sort of thing has been terrific, and the people have been great, the energy's been great, so I'm having a good time.
Oh, that's good.
Glad I came.
Stephanie Kelton, the website is
neweconomicperspectives.org.
Neweconomicperspectives.org. We will put that on the front page of majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Appreciate
Thanks.
It.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Going to take a brief moment and see who is going to sit down next. Give us 1 second. We'll be right back. Let's see. How about that? Oh, bear with me 1 more second. Ladies and gentlemen, I am back live at Netroots Nation. Wait, didn't we talk yesterday, Kyle?
Yeah, we already talked.
God,
I was
you
joking.
Know, you know, like I'm sitting down, going, like, wait a second. I interviewed Kyle yesterday.
No need.
All right. Well, no, we got Shannon Moore is going to be here very shortly.
Sure.
And we're going to be talking to Gaius Publius from America Blog. And I have been so out of it today.
Same.
It is. Maybe I drank too much last night. I slept through the meetup.
Yeah.
I sat down for a nap. And I was like, I gotta take a nap for 20 minutes. And like 2.5 hours later, oh my God. And I missed the meetup last night.
Yeah.
But you know, to be fair to myself, it was not. I nobody had given me details. And then yesterday, Jay from the Best of the Left said I wasn't there. And I think he was joking. No, he said I wasn't invited. And I think he was joking. In retrospect, I think he was, but I think
to be fair to Jay, he's very dry.
He's so very dry.
You're not sure, which way is up with him.
Yes, no, but I think he was joking. But I think, like in my head, I absorbed that.
Yeah, and you were like, you know what? I'm not invited to that event. I'm going to take a nap.
I'm going to take a nap. I'm going to sleep right through it.
I'm going to take an action, a positive step.
So, Kyle, what do you attend when you're here? Is it
I haven't gone to anything
a tech
yet.
Agenda yet? Or is what do? You go around to the booths and look at like the gadgets or?
Yeah, I'll take a tour on the exhibit floor. I'm mostly just here. It feels like everyone's just here to network. I don't know how much work is actually going on.
Yeah, I that's my sense too. Is that people are here to just sort of make connections and to build alliances and.
But yeah, there isn't something. I mean, I'm sure there are some tech events, but nothing that really caught my eye. So,
Kyle, thanks for keeping Gaius's seat warm. Do you want to take a seat?
All right. Well,
I didn't mean to summarily dismiss
tonight,
you.
When I need to go out, I'm going to think about this and take a nap.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes.
Thanks.
We'll have dinner tonight. Joining me now from do you have a little time? Okay. What's that? Oh, yeah, turn. Yeah, let's tilt the camera just a little bit this way. Okay. All right, there we go. Gaius Publius. Is it Publius or Publius?
You know, I've been waiting for 3 years for you to ask me that question, Sam. It's Publius.
But you know, I'll tell you how I knew this. Is that David Dayan sat down, and he was talking about Res Publica. And I said, no, it's Publica. And no, it's Publica. And so then it occurred to me it's going to be Gaius Publius.
Except in the United States, it can be Publius. But it's Gaius Publius, yes.
Okay. So Gaius Publius from America Blog is here. And let me ask you this question. I interviewed Charlie Pierce earlier in the program, and he said he was surprised by the lack of environmental presence here. And I want to get your sense, because I know this is something that you've been focusing on quite a bit, is climate change. I want to get your sense. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it's accurate. And this actually connects to something else I work on and I write about, which I know you're concerned about, which is the state of the Progressive Coalition and how it interacts with the Democratic Party. There's actually quite, as we talked last year, an unspoken kind of distance, a split between the two groups of people that are attending this conference. And I'm aware of a very kind of a deadness about this as I walked around yesterday. If you compare Elizabeth Warren's speech, which was loaded, and I walked in late, and from outside this hall on the first floor, I could hear the cheering on the third floor.
Mm-hmm.
You compare that to Chuck Schumer last night. Chuck Schumer, a third of the hall was filled, and people were checking their cell phones and walking out to go to the bathroom.
Right. I haven't even heard. I think this is the first time I've had anybody even say the words Chuck Schumer to me.
Chuck Schumer talked about immigration reform like he was saying wonderful things to progressives, and he tied it to Microsoft's being able to hire more H-1B-1 visas because their engineer, they just can't hire American engineers. I know for a fact, A, that that's not true. There's all kinds of American engineers. It's just that they want a full wage instead of an Indian wage.
Right.
And B, Microsoft is laying off.
Right.
Which Chuck is not aware of. Chuck, my friend Chuck.
Your good friend Chuck.
Not aware of. So that's the split in this room, in this convention, and nobody's talking about it. But there's all this progressive energy that says, look, the Democrats have to be held to account too, as you know, because I listen to you. And nobody's talking this. So those issues that Democrats are not necessarily good at.
Do you think that
present.
There's not that much of a talk there? Because almost everybody here is on that page on some level. I mean, I don't get the sense. I mean, you know, and granted, I am in a fairly myopic, you know, I'm stuck sitting down here for most of the time. And then when I go out and talk to other people, they are generally of like mind about that perspective. Do you think there's really that divide here, or do you think that divide exists in the Democratic Party? I mean, the reason why I don't hear that divide here is because I don't think that divide is here on some level. That's why there was only a third of the room filled when Chuck Schumer was there. I mean, or do you think that the people just aren't talking? What is it that's not being talked about?
So I'm on a lot of online communities. I'm on mailing lists and so forth. You and I share some. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few people. So my joke is I'm wearing an Elizabeth Warren sticker right now. I'm from the Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party. My joke is that I'm under color of the enemy. I'm really from the go-along-to-get-along wing of the Democratic Party. I'm from the I'm-for-hire-for-any campaign you want to run wing of the Democratic Party. And there's a fair, in the activist community of the Democratic Party, there's an awful lot of people who are for-hire because, of course, they have to make a living, but they're for hire for sometimes the wrong thing. And their values work against real progressive values.
And do you think they're here?
Of course. Okay. I could run a whole mess of names. They're here. They're good people. They're wonderful people.
I don't like them. I don't talk to them.
I won't name groups okay. and I won't name names. All but right. this is what fuels the party when somebody says, go vote for Democrats. These are the people that are actually doing that groundwork. People who worked for OFA, for example, in 2012.
Interesting. All right. Well, tell me again about the environmental perspective.
So just to transition, the climate is an issue on which Obama is trying to appear very, very good on, and he's actually very, very bad on, and that's a discussion that's not being had. What's going on with climate is that we do not have a carbon budget. I've been digging through James Hansen's scientific literature from 2008 on. I've got a bit of a physics background, so I can read this stuff, and I can translate it. The IPCC is going to meet in 2015 in Paris to try to hammer out a treaty, last crack at a treaty. And the fact is they're going to say we can burn up to the trillionth ton, how much is left. And the fact is we can't burn the next ton of carbon because there's no carbon budget. And that's the discussion we're going to have. But within the mainstream world, it's going to be an argument over how much carbon is burnable because how much carbon can Exxon monetize before it has to stop. Mm. There's zero burnable carbon, and the science says so.
And, you know, I'm surprised, like, Bill McKibben's not here this year. I've seen him in the past. I mean, what accounts for that absence here? Is there an absence? Because you're part of that environmental community.
I think it, to some degree, has to do with the selection committee for panels. I mean, you can bring a lot of people here if you get them on panels. If Bill McKibben had a panel, he'd be here. There was an opportunity to get Rick Perlstein here. That panel was not selected. I'm sure there's a very good reason for that. But we'd have Rick Perlstein if that panel was selected.
Right.
So there you go. There's the process.
All right. Well, Gaius Publius, thank you so much for stopping by.
Always it is my pleasure. Sam Cedar, to be here.
Okay. We'll talk to you soon. All right, folks. Will you get Matt Dust and Ali Grab for me? All right. And so we're going to keep it rolling here.
Oh.
Well, I would love all three of you, but I only have two mics. But if you guys want to share mics... Okay. Let's get another chair over here. Oh, this is great. This is like a power panel, ladies and gentlemen, that is coming to... this would be the better mic to share, yeah.
All right, this is, you take this one.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, this is like a super power panel.
This is, could be the most powerful panel that I've ever assembled. never mind at Netroots, but in any location. With me now is Matt Duss. Matt, what is your new title? You have a new title.
Yeah, as of August, I will be the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace.
Good luck with that.
Thank you very much.
But we will talk about that. And sitting next to Matt Duss is Ali Grab, and he is the Think Progress.
No. Former Think Progress.
A former Think Progress.
Reporting fellow at the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute.
Oh, okay. That is new. And Heather Hulbert, and you have a new title since you were last here.
Senior Fellow for National Security.
Hold on. Wait a second. Sorry. Try that again.
See, we're so powerful that we couldn't have all the mics on it.
That's right. I didn't want to blow the system out.
Yeah. But, senior Fellow for National Security at Human Rights First.
And, all right. So... we got a lot to talk about, a lot more, I think, to talk about than perhaps you anticipated a week ago. There's two things going on sort of simultaneously. Let's start with, I don't know if this is the easier one, but a plane being shot down in Ukraine. It is... it's not clear who did it yet, I guess, or is it, Heather?
Well, the U.S. government has certainly been saying pretty strongly that they think that it's been interesting to me, I should say. We know what system did it. It seems as if various sides have that system. But what I've been reading coming out of the intelligence community, they seem to be pretty sure in pointing fingers at the Russians. And I'm guessing that has something to do with satellite imagery and having been able to see where the missiles came from.
So so they think it's the Russians.
Sorry, I should have said the Russian separatist groups within Ukraine.
Okay.
You also had, I mean, yesterday, these Russian separatist groups bragging about shooting down an Antonov. And I just have to add, you know, for people who know anything about Russia, the idea that you could confuse an Antonov transport plane with, you know, a state-of-the-art passenger jet, it really says something about these guys' level of enthusiasm versus competence.
Right. And I would imagine a cargo plane going to fly that high as well, or no? So there was a lot of wishful thinking.
You can sort of imagine the environment. And, you know, also we saw this morning, by the way, there were two other passenger jets within 25 miles when this happened. So it does sort of look like these guys, you know, it's a little bit like Fantasy Island. Oh, the plane! Boom. Or, you know, the really cynical interpretation is, did someone set someone up to do this on purpose in order to embarrass someone else?
Ali, do you want to tell us what Heather meant by that? Do you have a sense? I mean, you tell me, Heather, who were you, who set... If someone was to have that perspective,
who would benefit?
Yes.
Well, you do have to keep in mind that the Russian intelligence services have been accused of doing things like bombing their own civilians in the past in order to create political pretexts for things. So, my hope is that this turns out to be a tragic mistake. And one of the reasons that wars is not just because wars kill people, but mistakes kill other people. Sometimes we seem to forget why war is a bad idea today. But it does also seem possible that someone, and I see the Russian government as having the most to benefit from a confused situation where there's a lot of anger and you are trying to pin it on Ukraine. Now I'm not normally the biggest conspiracy theorist of the three of us, so I feel like I should yield to my colleagues.
I'm normally the biggest conspiracy theorist.
Okay, let's before we get to that conspiracy, we're having a little bit of problem with the static with our broadcast. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back after this.
Sick then, take medicine.
All right, we are back. I don't know what that is, folks, why we have that. All of a sudden, we all turn robotic, and now we're good, I think. And so, we were basically saying that there's maybe a motive by the. Well, all right, we're going to go to Ali, who's going to tell us about what the more conspiratorial perspective was.
Well, no, I mean, I am the biggest conspiracy theorist here by dint of being Iranian, but I actually think that the most likely explanation is probably an accident, because, you know, this looks really bad for the pro-Russian separatists. You know, a lot of these guys are amateurs, and they're given...
Okay, we are back. So, all right, let's start back. You are conspiratorial by nature because of your Iranian heritage.
Yes.
So do tell.
It's. I don't know if you've read the Weekly Standard and Commentary, but conspiracy theories are in my DNA.
I understand. Yes. I mean, it's... I'm frankly terrified just sitting here. But,
no, I mean, I think it probably was an accident, and I think it's... And the reason I think it was probably an accident is because it is such a PR disaster. But to Heather's conspiratorial point, the Russians are pretty bad at making PR predictions about their own actions. So it's entirely possible that they could have tried something like this and not realized that it would backfire and it would hurt any support for the rebels they support in eastern Ukraine. But I think it probably was just that these guys were amateurs with sophisticated weapons that they shouldn't
have had. Yeah, you made that point
had.
Before we went out, is that the Russians are giving guys who have no training or limited training, I guess, weapons that really should be in the hands of people who have been trained.
Right. I do think it's important to note, if people aren't aware already, I mean, this is not like a shoulder-fired rocket. It's an entire system with requires radar training, pretty serious expertise to use, and it doesn't appear that these guys have any of that.
Right. It's not easy to hit a plane that's 33,000 feet in the air, is my understanding. So let's...
you know that, Sam.
How do I know that? I just... I read it online somewhere, I guess. but, all right, so what happens next, Matt? What do we hope will happen next?
Well, what I hope and think will happen next is that, you know, events like this have a tendency to sort of galvanize, you know, countries. The question is how much more willing and how quickly can Europe in particular get behind pressure on Russia. But I think the administration's approach to this, and this is where we have a connection to the Iran issue, is that the Obama administration, even as they have been constantly criticized by hawks for not being more aggressive, I think it's been very smart the way that they've actually made this, you know, a kind of multilateral effort to put the pressure on Russia, make Iran the focus here, rather than kind of asserting the United States more strongly and turning it into kind of an international urinating contest between Russia and the United States, which is what Putin would love it to be.
So when you say make Iran the focus, you're talking about the talks and you're talking about... This issue with Ukraine is subsidiary to the agenda with Iran.
Well, what I'm saying is, like, looking at... That's an interesting connection there, but I'm saying there, too, the way he's kept the focus on Russia with regard to its intervention in Ukraine, rather than making it about the United States. But at the same time, and this is an interesting scenario because Russia is actually a partner in the way that the Obama administration has worked with Russia and other partners to keep the focus on Iran with regard to the nuclear issue.
Okay. All right, so let's turn to now Israel's invasion, I guess you'd say, of Gaza. It seems, I mean, this is the first time I think they've invaded in years.
Since 2008.
Yeah. And they seem to be in, at least they're indicating that they may go in for a long time. I mean, this isn't... Are we back to mowing the lawn, as they used to refer to it, or is this maybe rototilling? I mean, to belabor.
Right. No, I think we were at mowing the lawn before the invasion. And again, as an offensive term as that is, it does describe what it has been essentially the policy of Israel toward Gaza, which is, you know, every once in a while, every couple of years, we'll have to bomb the crap out of it to diminish the store of rockets.
Right. We need to kill a certain amount of people. We need to inflict a certain amount of damage on the infrastructure. Mm. But
not in such a way that completely collapses the ability of Hamas to control more extreme factions. So just cut the grass a little bit, but leaving that government in place, weakened but in place.
And now, let's go back down to Heather. Hasn't Hamas been, at least prior to this, was politically weaker than they had been in the past? Does this end up making Hamas politically stronger? Where does it leave Hamas, and what is the? I mean. Undoubtedly, that's part of the calculation for Netanyahu, right? I mean, here's a guy who there's a sense that he is politically weakened, and this is sort of like the last refuge of politicians, right? Is to sort of build up the enemy that you want to have so that you can get the domestic support, right? I mean, is that the dynamic that's going on here?
Well, the other piece of the dynamic that's a little different from recent years is the role of Egypt, and that you now have a government in Egypt that is quite interested in seeing Hamas weakened as much as possible because of the connection they perceive between Hamas, which is a Muslim Brotherhood organization, and the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, which, remember, the current Egyptian government just outlawed. So Netanyahu now has a partner in Cairo in desiring to weaken Hamas further. And interestingly, as opposed to, I think, your suggestion, which is one that many outside analysts have thought, that actually you wouldn't want to weaken Hamas because what comes after Hamas is more extreme, less restrained,
right,
less interested in governing.
That Hamas is weakened in this situation, it seems to me that it is only strengthening either more violent, more radical elements, and or you're strengthening Hamas. I mean, this is not helping the moderates, because Hamas seem to have at least either by choice or by circumstance had been moderating because they had lost a certain amount of political power. I mean, is that...
Yeah. I mean, I think the kindest way I can describe this is that there was the hope or belief on the Israeli side that you could somehow make Hamas, that you could stop Hamas from being perceived as a moderate alternative. And, you know, that you could de-moderate Hamas. And I think that's a mistake, to think that you can influence someone else's internal politics, and you certainly can't influence them this way.
But was that the reason why Netanyahu did this, or was it because...
He got the opportunity to do it.
Well, for him, it helps him domestically, doesn't it, to demonize, to make a moderate Hamas seem more militant.
Well, I think we have to go back to the unity deal between Fatah and Hamas that was announced several months ago. You had a situation in which talks had broke down. Abu Mazen, the leader of Fatah, the leader of the PLO, entered into a unity deal with Hamas, largely on Fatah's terms. Hamas was isolated. They'd lost the support of Egypt and other supporters. They basically came into this deal having conceded a great, great deal. You then had the opportunity to bring the Palestinian Authority back into Gaza to deal with the situation and to deal possibly with the problem of tunnels, the problem of rockets. Netanyahu made a different choice. He took the opportunity of the kidnapping of these three teenagers in the West Bank, an enormous tragedy, no question, but he used that as a pretext to carry out this wide, broad crackdown in the West Bank, essentially to undermine the unity deal. And we saw this problem spiral. You take these actions, arresting hundreds of Hamas activists, including some 50 who had been released just a few years ago as part of the Gilad Shalit deal, and create a situation where Hamas feels it now has to respond. And then, of course, Israel has to respond to Hamas's response.
Right. I mean, this seems to be fairly calculated, and I think at least part of that is, I've read the report that the Israelis were aware for weeks that these abducted teenagers were dead.
Boys were probably dead, yeah.
And yet there was a campaign to invest people in this search for them.
It was to whip up a nationalist frenzy against Hamas. And, you know, it's These are the two men that the Israeli Internal Security Service has pinpointed as the main suspects in the kidnapping and murder of those three Israeli teens were Hamas members, but from a sort of incredibly radical strain of Hamas that's based in the West Bank town of Hebron, and a strain known to act rogue and against the Hamas leadership's wishes. But that didn't stop Netanyahu from making this an issue about the whole organization. And the point that you're talking about these boys having probably been dead and the government knowing about it, they placed a gag order on it in the Israeli media. And you had things like Noam Shezef, the great Israeli reporter.
I'm sorry, they placed a gag order on the reports that they were dead, or
on
that?
On the 911 call.
Okay.
The emergency services call that the boys made, where you could hear at the end gunshots and then singing in Arabic, which, you know, the indication is that
they've
something terrible
these
happened
kids.
Here. Okay. That these guys had the 911 call, you know, the day after, and there was a gag order put on the Israeli media about talking about it for a couple weeks until the bodies were discovered, and then it came out. And also there was a really unfortunate circumstance where the families of one of the boys had thought they had been misled by the government as to the government having found blood and bullet holes in a car that apparently had been used by the boys at some point. And you know, Noam Shezef, this great Israeli reporter, wrote about the dynamic of feeding this frenzy sort of by manipulating Israeli public opinion by making them think that these boys are still out there and Hamas did it. He said that schools all over Israel, including one right down his house, were having the kids make these banners and hanging them up on the schools that said, you know, the three boys' names, and we look forward to having you home. And that's something that no teacher in their right mind would have a kid do if you knew that these three Israeli teens were probably already dead. And it's the kind of thing that sets up this environment where when they are finally found dead, it creates this crushing emotional blow. And then there's, you know, the sorts of call for revenge that we saw that, you know, admittedly are acted upon violently by the Israeli fringes. But these sorts of things seem to me to be kind of inevitable when you create this environment where people want to go out and get revenge.
And I mean, I guess, maybe this is a conspiratorial streak in me, but I don't, you know.
Are you Iranian too?
I am not, but I had some friends. but it seems to me that even characterizing as sort of inevitable or in spite of the fact that these suspects were part of a fringe element of Hamas that is to go rogue, this seems like this was seen as an opportunity for Netanyahu. Like this
Absolutely.
was mission accomplished in a way that seems to be these guys really knew how to take advantage of the situation. They were probably waiting for an opportunity like this, which is not hard to imagine is going to show up.
Yeah, you're right. Nothing about this was inevitable. And I would say, you know, as Ali said, this hardline faction of Hamas very possibly was seeking to undermine
right,
the unity
of
deal.
Course. This has so been all the story of these various for decades
right.
now, right? Is that there is always the one thing that is inevitable is that there are extremists on both sides and both looking to exploit to basically join up with the extremists on the other side. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to, right?
Mirror images.
Yes, and they need each other. They have a symbiotic relationship. And so, so Heather, what should America be doing now? I mean, what should the United States be doing?
It's a softball, Sam.
Yeah, there we go.
So, you know,
you have 2 minutes. How can America solve this?
The piece of this that is inevitable is that as long as for each side the changing the status quo looks not worth it, then we're going to keep going through this over and over. And I think for me, the most single depressing piece of this is that what's happening is appalling. The fate of the three Israeli boys is appalling. The revenge killings are appalling. The indiscriminate killings of civilians in Gaza is appalling. The indiscriminate use of civilians as shields in Gaza is also appalling. And I see nothing that moves us out of the cycle, that I see nothing that changes. So to not duck the question, what Washington has got to do, and this isn't a short-term fix, but is to look around and say, what are the powers on both sides that could actually move this somewhere else, and then be braver about supporting them? You know, look, one thing is, it's very clear Netanyahu is not interested in making a deal. So then you have to say to yourself, really, nothing can happen until there's a different political constellation in Israel. And then you have to make a decision, how much can or should the U.S. try to influence that? But that's really kind of your intellectual piece number one. And then piece number two is, you know, as both Ali and Matt said, this is going to hurt. It hurts everybody in Palestine. What kind of force do you want to see come out of this in Palestine? Who do you want to have legitimacy? What can you do to support that?
I mean, it seems to me it's the question, Ali, as to what can or should United States do. Can seems pretty clear, right? I mean, we have billions of tiny little levers, it seems to me, with the Israeli government.
You read my mind, Sam. I mean, look, I'm going to say something that you won't hear in D.C. a lot, and that's that we got to think about this. Yeah, Netanyahu's not going to make a peace deal. The next prime minister might be his current foreign minister, who's a proto-fascist named Avigdor Lieberman.
Right.
How far down this path do we have to go where the elected Israeli governments keep making totally strategically senseless decisions before we say, hey, listen, we're going to stop paying a fifth of your defense budget and subsidizing the perpetual occupation of the Palestinian territories and subsidizing your harming the prospects for peace by doing things like trying to destroy the unity government. And by the way, the Israelis, including Netanyahu, have said for years now, how can we expect it to negotiate with a divided Palestinian polity? Well, when that polity tries to make moves to get together, granted with a totally nefarious group of a-holes like Hamas, the Palestinian politics were starting to come together in some form of unity that maybe down the road would see Hamas agree to the sorts of conditions that could create a negotiated peace. And then Netanyahu goes and uses the tragedy of this kidnapping as a pretext to try and destroy that arrangement. You know, how long can we let this go on while we're essentially funding it?
The United Government was always Netanyahu's greatest nightmare. Right? Because it basically calls his bluff. And so that is why they needed any opportunity they could to undermine that unity government and to undermine any progress. I mean, that is what it was. And I think, Matt, let me ask you this. Do you think there is a growing understanding of this? I mean, we've seen this play so many times now. And it is so naked, I think, at this point. You know, like it does seem over the past, you know, 10 years that I've been doing radio and talking about this, back in the day when we'd get a call from the Israeli embassy, hey, you know, we would love to come on and talk to you and Janine about what you said last night about Israel. It seems that there is a broader awareness in the body politic in this country that this is really the story, is that whenever there is a move in the right direction, it is undermined by a growing Israeli right that, and maybe that encompasses much of the country at this point. Do you think there's a growing awareness in this country that, like, you know, we may actually, it's harder to justify not using our leverage?
I mean, I think there's a growing awareness and a growing debate amongst progressives on this. And in the kind of foreign policy community, I think there's detangling, okay, how much of this impacts the United States, our interest, our strategic interest in the region, our relationships in a region that is just completely falling apart in so many different ways. Where you really don't see it reflected yet is on the Hill in Congress. But I do think it's worth noting, you know, what we saw earlier this year with related to Iran. You had an Israeli government that was absolutely opposed to this deal, was very supportive of new sanctions, And you did see progressives coming together and very successfully working with our members of Congress and to push back that effort. I think it's a different question as to when this actually relates to the Israel-Palestine conflict specifically, because I think that's something it's harder to make the case for a lot of Americans that this is something that they should be very immediately concerned about.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, because, you know, much of what we're discussing is sort of the implications, at least morally, I think, as to what America should do with its leverage, as opposed to, like, you know, in the long run, we could keep doing this. It doesn't really hurt us. So what difference does it make? But Heather.
Yeah, I want to sound a note of caution here, because I think it's very nice for us to, and it's sort of ironic for us on the progressive side to be telling ourselves, oh, we have all those dollars of leverage and we just have to use them. My prediction, if you want Avigdor Lieberman as the prime minister, the fastest way to make that happen is a big cut in the aid. It is a huge mistake to not see sort of independent activism within Israel and, like them or not, the choices and perceptions of Israeli citizens as the primary determinants of Israeli action. So while not saying that Israel ought to be getting or needs to be getting the level of resources that it is from the U.S., it is not as simple as we turn off the switch and the policy and players turn into people we like.
I don't necessarily want to use this aid money at a lever. I just kind of want to wash my hands of it.
All right. Well, I mean, so Heather, you're suggesting that the Israeli public would react to Americans actually starting to pull back some support in defiance of the United States? I mean, is that the theory that would bring us?
Yeah, I mean, for years now, those in the U.S. who wanted to influence Israeli politics one way or the other have had to be more and more careful. And there's more and more resentment, which ought to be totally understandable to any American, at the idea that somehow Americans, because we give money, can control what happens in Israel. And Israelis are like, look, you're not the ones who die here. We are. So we get to make our own decisions. And, you know, years ago, when I was in government and we were, you know, talking about an Israeli election, and I said to a Jewish American of my acquaintance, you know, what's the best way to get Bibi Netanyahu not reelected? And this person said to me, endorse him, because, you know, Israelis resent American pressure. So yes, the pressure has a role. Yes, the status quo is not working, not morally palatable, not good for Israelis, by the way, not good for people who really care about Israel's security. But don't imagine that there's a one-for-one relationship between dollars and policy.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, I think, you know, ultimately, with at one point, and I would say it's probably like 6-7 years away, but at one point when Congress, when redistricting happens, I think Israel is going to find that they're losing a lot of their support in Congress.
Well, and I think Ali actually said something really important, which is that at a certain point, what Americans do is just say, hey, I don't care about you and your mess anymore. Right. I just don't want to be engaged. And so this assumption that that the U.S. can keep being a positive force, you know, the biggest worry here is people just say, hey, this is disgusting. I don't have time to sort it all out. There's no way of sorting it all out. All these people, I'm just tired of dealing with it. I just want to take my marbles and go home.
Yeah. Well, Heather Hulbert, Ali Garab, and Matt Duss, thank you so much for being here. I genuinely appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, Sam.
Thanks for
super
having us.
Power panel. All right. We're going to take a actually, we're not even going to take a break. We're just going to invite over our...
Ejector button on the seats.
Yeah, exactly. We have just hit the... And I think they're all now sliding down into the basement of the thing. No problem. And joining me now at the microphone is a pleasure to welcome back to the program partial namesake of the blog Daily Kos. Is it Daily Kos or Cause?
Daily Kos, like
okay,
Marcos.
Yeah, okay, Kos. Marcos Melitzis. Hello, Marcos.
Oh, my God, always a pleasure. Always.
So good to see you. Well, here we are again, year 9. I ask you this question every year because it's like literally having turkey on Thanksgiving now for me. But what do you think? I mean, how is it evolving from when... 9 years ago, we had this exact same conversation. We were in a skybox overseeing a convention hall in, I don't even know if that hotel is still standing in Las Vegas.
It might
anymore.
Not be.
Back when this was Yearly Co's, I think it was in year three it became Netroots Nation.
Yes.
And give me your sense of how this has developed. I mean, what's different now than that?
Yeah, the big difference now is that this is a confident and movement that has arrived. We no longer need to justify ourselves. We no longer need to be validated by anyone else. I mean, great, you know, Joe Biden came. Woo, good for him. It's nice for stopping by, but had he not come, who cares?
Like, right.
Those early years, it was a little different. The first one was in Vegas where we talked, and we were marginalized. We were laughed at. We were a big joke inside the party establishment, inside the liberal movement in general. There was a lot of hostility back then between us and labor and us and sort of the old guard organizations because people like us looked at them and said, you know, you guys have just lost, right? What have you done but lose? And they look at us and go, oh, a bunch of guys with computers, they're going to really change things, right? And we were both right. I mean, that early hostility has sort of faded away, and now we're, I mean, I can't think of any major organization that doesn't have a strong Netroots presence.
Right.
But it goes beyond that because about 6 years ago, I said, okay, that tension's gone. Now we're in year nine. What's different now? What's different now is that the people that were sort of low-level staffers in those organizations or early pioneers in the Netroots are now running organizations
right.
like NARAL.
Right.
And so, Emily's List right. and so on. So we not having just graduated to, like, we're respectable, but those early pioneers are now actually running the show. Not everywhere. There's still
right.
some holdouts. But it's amazing to see how far we've come in. And we're no longer worried about, oh, people take us seriously. People take us seriously. Now we're focused on, and panels at this conference are really focused on things like how to walk a precinct, how to build a walk list, how to write an effective email. I mean, these are things we're learning how to win elections as opposed to look at us, take us seriously. We actually matter.
You know, the union thing is I think, like, one of the singular biggest changes. I guess it was year three, maybe. I can't remember. I remember the party.
Uh-huh.
There was a party outside. I don't remember where we were located, but there was a party outside. And it was in the afternoon, and it was the first time, like, there was a union presence. And they had a truck. I think there was, like, a big
18-wheeler. Yeah.
And I can't remember where that was.
I think it was Chicago. So that might have been year two.
Maybe that was year three, I think, in
2000.
Well, maybe it was year two,
yeah, year,
2007.
Year two. Yeah.
But that was, like, it was a big deal because there was some real tension.
Yeah.
The other thing I notice is that there's a lot more institutions here as opposed to sort of individual bloggers.
Yeah, it definitely has become a sort of a trade industry conference as opposed to the heavy grassroots conference that it was before. And it has a role because obviously we're all learning from each other. We're learning how to be effective in Netroots activism. But it's a lot of people who work for organizations. And the sort, and there's still a fairly decent grassroots presence, but it doesn't dominate the way it used to. And one of the things we have planning at Daily Coast is we're going to create, not a conference to compete or anything, but what we want to start doing is doing, like, salons around the country where we bring together members of our community, which is millions strong, and heavily focus on them and teaching them how to organize from that grassroots level in a way that I think this place is missing. So I don't want to cast aspersions on Netroots Nation because it's become what it has become because it's a valuable service and people
right.
are making use of it and it's helping us win on our issues and on elections. But that, you know, I definitely would like to bolster that grassroots presence, and if Netroots Nation's not the place for it, it's expensive to come here. I mean, how many people have $1,000 to
right.
get tickets and get a hotel room and then get the... So we want it at Daily Coast. We want to start go to people around the
and
country.
And do more regional organizing.
Exactly.
Interesting. And I know. I managed
I'm
going to
have an epileptic seizure. This light
only,
is flashing.
We've got a light that is now sort of flashing above us. And literally, there is, I think, hundreds of fluorescent lights. And this is the only one,
right?
And it is directly above us that is flashing.
The message.
I also lost the internet connection that we had today. There's something about this booth, but I've lost my train of thought. But
this idea of regionally organizing. Oh, I know what the point I wanted to make was. The other thing that I've noticed is that I'm fairly convinced, and I have no data to back this up, but I actually think that if you looked at the average age of a participant in 2005, the first one, versus now, I actually think that age is lower.
It is, and it's not by accident. I mean, there's been a very concerted effort, not just on age, but also on ethnicity and race as well. That first conference, I mean, again, let's go back. Who can afford $1,000 plus to go to a political conference far away from home, right?
Right.
So it naturally skewed to people who were older and wealthier and white. It's just the socioeconomic reality. So
and there was no I mean, I don't think there was organization sending people to the year.
No, there wasn't. I mean, nobody took it seriously. Again, it goes back to the first point. It wasn't taken seriously. Democracy for America was one of the first to really dedicate significant resources into creating a scholarship program. And they bring together some incredible activists from all over the country. We ourselves at Daily Coast, we had scholarships for 10 local activists, people who otherwise wouldn't be able to come in. And also some of the immigration groups also bringing in some of the Dreamer kids. And so there's been a concerted effort to diversify this, because these are skills that serve a movement that really serves a broad, diverse cross-section of America, and it needs to reflect that if it is to effectively speak to that Democratic coalition.
You know what's also interesting to me is that I was watching last night the news, and they were running Joe Biden, I guess, revealing what the American government knew about the shooting down of this plane in Ukraine. And on MSNBC, I saw it played at least multiple times. They did not say he was at Netroots Nation. They said he was talking in Detroit. It was interesting. And yet, in that first yearly COS, there, you know, Maureen Dowd came. There was I almost think that there was more media coverage when they thought we're going to find people walking around on stilts and you know, eating Cheetos, and it's going to be a freak show. That dynamic, on one hand, I totally get it. It also is a scary dynamic in the sense that, you know, people still show up, a lot of press at CPAC, because the freak show is actually there, and it delivers year in, year out. I mean, talk about that dynamic.
There's a famous blog post from a conservative blogger, Michelle Malkin, that she sent somebody to infiltrate to find all the crazy stuff that was happening in Vegas in that first yearly COS. And his first dispatch was, well, you know, people seem kind of normal, and they follow Western standards of hygiene. And it's sort of like, he was shocked, right? Because they painted this caricature of what a liberal looks like. And they came in and was like, oh, my God, it looks like normal people. And so they were looking for the freak show. And Maureen Dowd wrote that I was the leader of a cult. And it was just crazy stuff.
Now, coincidentally, you're also a leader of a cult.
She was right for the wrong reasons.
Exactly.
But
you don't let them travel, so they would have never shown up. In right? They're back on your.
They're in the basement, right?
They can't get out of there. They're not allowed to.
But this again speaks to the maturity of the movement, right? I mean, we were a novelty. We were different. We were, you know, essentially crashing the gate at the time. And now this is a very transactional conference. It's people are coming here to learn how to effectively do things, how to engage in activism, how to be a good activist, how to, like I said, like walk lists and how to send a good email, and how to I'm going to be chairing a panel tomorrow on how to do a political startup. That's not sexy for the news, and it shouldn't be sexy for the news, because we're not doing it for them. And what's even sort of more telling to me is we are advancing dramatically on the issues that we care about, whether it's marriage equality or on the women's rights front. I mean, the collapse in support for women among women for Republicans is stark, and it's not happening because they're watching David Gregory speak to these issues on Meet the Press. They're not talking about it because it's wall-to-wall coverage on the nightly news. They're getting this information somehow. They're hearing about Todd Akin and Richard Murdoch and the new crop, the 2014 class of crazy women haters. Where are they getting this information? Not from the traditional media. And I'm not going to say not from the blogs, because the blogs sort of become blurred with media, right?
Right.
What they're doing is they're getting it from everywhere. It's just a fragmented market. A lot of it is Facebook. Daily Coast reaches 7 to 8 million unique visitors per month, which is pretty impressive, right? That's 2% crazy. Of the U.S. population. We reach between 12 and 20 million people on Facebook every day, our content.
Wow.
And, yeah, I mean, we're not making money off it because it's somebody, you know, Facebook's making money off it. We're right. not. But that's not the point here. The point is that we're spreading the message and people are getting it and it's moving numbers. And not just us, but every organization that is here and, you know, stuff that you're doing, everybody here on this media row, you know, everybody's reaching, a little segment of the population. And collectively, we are out informing the American public. So whether they come here or not is absolutely irrelevant. I mean, there was an NBC reporter that stopped me yesterday. I don't have my camera crew. I got to talk to you later. You're going to be around because I want to ask you about 16. I want to ask you about Hillary. It's like, okay, see right there, you've already – this is not – this. We're
right.
People here are looking at 14. And, yeah, there's some Hillary Warren stuff. I get it. But – that's not what's important right
that's
now.
That's definitely a
and I know you're coming here. You're looking for that conflict. You're looking for that Hillary versus Warren. You're looking for that grassroots hate Hillary storyline. That's what you're looking for. But you'll get that at CPAC. So, right. Yeah, it's catnip for the media. Not to mention it's in D.C. to make it convenient for the media, right?
Right.
This is, like I said, it's a much more transactional. Maybe it makes it a little sexy from a media standpoint. It makes it a hell of a lot more effective from a practical standpoint.
Right. Well, Marcos Melitzis, always a pleasure to see you and have a chance to sit down and talk. Hopefully we'll have the opportunity to do this again in the coming years.
Absolutely.
All right. Folks. I'm going to start to – let me take a quick break. We'll be right back so I can complain about this
light.
This light that is driving me insane.
It's an epileptic seizure.
Folks, I'm back. I'm going to take a couple of IMs, and then we're going to wrap up, and I'm going to we'll do some I'm literally the flashing lights here are driving me insane. Apologize about the static and everything. Tush and Payne, it was nice to meet a radio idol of mine in person. Now I just have to meet Howard Stern. I think Jay from Best Left introduced me to your program. Majority Report meetup last night. I wish I had made Where's Hugo buttons or something. I was wondering if you listened to Biden's speech. He mentions taxation issues such as carried interest and special carve-outs. And he also boasted about how he's one in the administration who is tasked with negotiating with the Senate. I felt it was particularly egregious for him to argue. Wasn't it quite crappy deal? He broke it on New Year's Eve. I heard the speech, only parts of it, and I thought it was – I mean, look, I'll be honest. I wasn't terribly interested in the first place. And
So I entered in with that, and then I thought he was just basically checking off a litany of issues that he thought people here wanted to hear. I thought saying, you know, when the protesters interrupted him by saying, please don't deport my families, and he's like, yes, we should clap for those people. And I wanted him to actually say, you know what, we probably shouldn't expedite sending these children back to their deaths or to their rapes or to the intense violence that they're living in. I would have liked to have seen something other than platitudes. So I wasn't. It was going to be a hard sell for me entering into listening to that speech, but I certainly I wasn't impressed. Cheney and Bush's Obama wouldn't want to visit those refugees because Republicans might call him a lawless, illegal alien sympathizer with an oriental or orientation. Oh, noes. All right, I'm going to have to sign off soon because this light thing is actually, it's just, the light is literally above me and it is relentless. So, resist war. It seems like NN is now only for electoral types, not activists, and populated by political pros who look down on us amateurs. No, I don't think that's accurate. I don't think that's accurate. There's a lot of organizations here that are activists and organizers. I don't think it's just electoral types. But what is not here are people who are sort of independent, I don't know, media voices is the right word, independent voices that are here outside of an organizational structure. It's a difference, but I don't think it's a fair characterization. Oh, jeez. Richard Skull, love Stephanie Kelton. I learned about her through your show. I listened to your last interview with her three times. Great. Mutt, hey, Sam, while in Michigan, you should come to Flint. It's only an hour and a half away, and it's every bit as interesting as the law for a lot of the same reasons. There's going to be a tour your own city going on tomorrow at the cost of $1 and runs from 10 to 4. Here's the, if you're interested, I'll check it out. Dr. Abinthes, Sam, to say everything everybody does is appalling in the Palestine-Israel conflict is tantamount to saying nothing. In terms of what Americans can do, I only suggest to divest from investments that have any connection to the settlement in the occupied territories and to boycott any corporations operating there. I don't trust our government as an honest broker there, and I don't want the U.S. doing anything in our name since it's not supporting democracy and autonomy for the Palestinian people. Yeah, I mean, I am in favor of the BDS movement. Teacher Lauren, hey, Sam, any update when and if you'll have Zephyr teach out on the show? I was hoping to have her here, but she didn't. She's not. It turns out she's not at the conference. So I'd also like to know where to find your interview with her from the other show so I can share it with my educator friends. I think it might be on SoundCloud. We got to pick it up. I'll find it. Umar's question. I believe under international law, people under occupation have the right to kill their occupiers, whether it be American soldiers in Iraq or Israeli soldiers in Gaza, regardless of the practical benefits, though it works sometimes, like Hezbollah kicking Israel out of South Lebanon in 2000. But does that right extend to adult male settlers that the occupying a nation allows to move into the stolen territory and are being protected by the soldiers? No, I don't think it. I don't think international law allows for the targeting of civilians, regardless. Fingers Malone, I second the guest request from yesterday. Please have Ali Bunima on as a guest to talk about the targeting of Israeli civilians. As a paying member, I beg of you, please seriously considering have him on. Gaza is a prison. People have nowhere to go. The entire population is a target. Crusher, what's your poison when you go for drinks? Gin or vodka, generally. Then beer and wine. Militant apathy. Yes, we can hear you. John McCain is in rare form about this. All right, folks. I think that's it for today. And, of course, Zima. Zima, of course, is a big drink for me. All right, folks. I will be back on Tuesday. live. Matt and Michael will be here on Monday. And, folks, we'll do a freebie Friday today, obviously. And if you have the opportunity to become a member, please, by all means, do. It is pennies a day. You can become a member at majority.fm. Just click on Become a Member. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And MajorityReportKickback.com. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. Folks, we'll see you tomorrow. I'm sorry. I'm completely thrown off by this. So the light is literally driving me crazy. All right, folks. See you soon.
That guy to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the rope that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. While I shifted in and out of gear, waiting for my moment to happen. I don't know how much longer I can stay in, or how much more I've got to pay to play in. I know somehow my life's got grading, somewhere before the credits faded. But my pilot light shining, pilot light shining bright.